Before I begin, I've just been very aware of the importance of today, that it's the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King. And it just brought back memories of that day, the absolute horror of it. But more than that, and I think this is all I'm going to say here, is just remembering how blessed we were by this extraordinary man and his vision, and especially his absolute commitment to nonviolence. And somehow that feels like it really relates to what we're doing here, and that to remember about cultivating nonviolence in ourselves, toward ourselves, and toward everybody in our lives, everybody we have come in contact with, just as well as however we engage in the great issues of our day. So I just think it's paying tribute to this great man on this day. Felt like had to start that way. So this talk came about in a rather unusual way. I hadn't decided what I was going to talk about when two words sort of dropped into my mind. And the two words were inspiring practice. And I thought, where did those come from? But they stuck. And I felt like I was being invited to reflect on this subject and talk about it together with you. And as I thought about it, you know, it both was a verb, you know, how do we inspire practice, but it was also an adjective, inspiring practice, you know, that practice is inspiring. So I started to play with that. And so I invite you to listen to some of the stories and see what touches you, see what you might want to experiment with. Now, just out of curiosity, is anybody here for the first time? Well, I want to welcome you especially. And the reason I asked is that we hear this word practice a lot, our practice. And I just wanted to make really clear that it's not only when we're sitting on the cushion or on the chair, but it's woven through all of our life, living with awareness, living mindfully, letting the Dharma be a sort of golden thread through our lives. So that's my understanding of practice. It includes everything. So I wanted to make a general observation that sometimes the most powerful teachings come to us in the smallest packages. It may be the words of a teacher, or it may be the words of a friend, it may be something you've read, a tape you've listened to, a video you've watched, or it might be an interaction with somebody. It can come anywhere, these moments of inspiration. Because the wisdom of the Dharma is everywhere. And it's about how we really wake up and become more conscious of how it's woven through our lives. So I want to start with an unlikely story, which I'm going to tell on myself as an example of one of these little things that happened that sort of propelled me to really think about it. So I had to go to a store I'd never been to before in the Fresh Pond Mall, called Nodell's. Now, I got this very fixed idea that this store was on the west side of the mall where Trader Joe's is. Forgive me for getting into Cambridge geography, but I have to do this for this story to make sense. So anyway, I even thought I'd seen the sign above one of the buildings, Nodell's, on that side of the mall. So I went to the west side of the mall, and I started walking around, all circling around all the stores, I couldn't find it. So I was feeling really put out by this. You know, it's like I had an errand to do. I wanted to get it done, right? So I went into a store because I don't know how yet how to find something on my smartphone. And somebody helped me find the number of the store. So I call up the store. I'm in the mall, right? And this very young sounding male voice answers the phone. Now you get this scene. I'm in a, there's a lot of confusion around. It's the mall. And I have trouble hearing him because he's talking about 5,000 miles a minute. And the older people in this room are laughing at this because they understand how hard this is. So anyway, he's trying to explain to me where this store is. He says, can you see the Fresh Pond Mall sign? And I said, well, I can see the CVS sign. And it went back and forth like this. Can you see this? Can you see that? It's like, I'm wild. It's like, why doesn't he tell me where this is? So finally he says, it's on the the Whole Foods side of the mall. Oh, I said, thank you. Now I'll be able to find you because I know where Whole Foods is. So anyways, I go over, I find what I'm looking for, and I come to the counter, and I know that this is my friend from the phone call. So I look at him, he's very young. And I say to him, I promise you, I don't usually do this. I reached over and I touched his arm. And I said, I just want to thank you for hanging in with me over that phone call. I said, I'm 80 years old and you have to be patient with us elders. He looked at me and he said, wow. You're still walking around. Well, why is this so funny? Well, first of all, I don't go around touching checkout people. Something made me want to reach towards him. We'd had such a tangled phone conversation, and I felt badly about my half of it. I sort of, you know what I mean. I just wanted to... I wanted to heal our relationship, we then went on from there. It was so sweet. It ended up being so sweet. Well, why am I telling you this story? Because I kept thinking about this little exchange. It got me to really reflect on, first of all, my mind had been so fixed that that store was on the other side. And do you ever do this? You just know you're right. You're 180% wrong. It's like, oh my God, I'm wrong. So that was a shock. It was showing me this tendency of the mind to grab hold and go into a sort of righteous stand. And then furthermore, it got me thinking about age. You know, first of all, he was about 20. You know, and here I was 60 years older. And, you know, that's all about impermanence and about change and about any views we have about age. Now, he saw me as absolutely ancient. And, you know, I don't really feel that way. And for any of you who are over 40, let's say, or whoever say, I can't believe how old I am, well... None of us can. And you know why? It's only your body that's that age. It's like the spirit, the soul, the life force, whatever you want to call it, is ageless. That awareness, I'll come back to. The self that we don't have is ageless. I'll come back to that too. Anyway, I just had to share that story. And I kept saying, do you want to share this story? Because it stimulated a lot of thought. And that's what we are looking for in our lives, is what is it that inspires us? What wakes us up? Now, because most of us here are lay practitioners, we're not monastics, and we're involved with work and we're families, perhaps, or we're very much engaged in the world, I want to talk to you about somebody that, it's funny, when I start thinking about, I started thinking about this talk, I was led immediately to a little book called Knee Deep in Grace, the story of Deepa Ma. And some of you have heard of her, yeah? Yeah. Now, why? Because she was a lay practitioner. But I want to tell you a little of her story because it's so inspiring. She had a tremendous influence on contemporary Buddhism, and she was also the teacher to a lot of our teachers, people like Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, Kate Wheeler, Jack Engler, people who give talks here like that, whom we may have done retreats with. So, and down in the teacher's room, there's a picture of Deepa Ma. She's there amongst all the other great Buddhist adepts. So I want to tell you her story very briefly. She was married very young, and she was unable to conceive a child, which in that culture is a really heavy, painful situation. It is in any, but particularly in India. And finally, she had a baby, but that infant died. And then she had another child, and that was a little girl named Deepa, and that's why she's called Deepa Ma. And then she had a little boy. Of course, they want little boys. And that little boy, infant, died. And she was just racked with sorrow and, you can imagine, grief over losing two babies. And then her own health began to go. She got typhoid. She got a very serious heart condition. So her dear husband, who stood by her through all of this, was taking care of her and the little girl, Deepa, and working. And he had a heart attack and died. So within 10 years, she had lost two children, both parents, I forgot to mention, both her parents died. She lost her health. She was dying. She was devastated. And she asked herself, what can I take with me when I die? Let me go to the meditation center. Maybe there I can find something to take with me when I die. So she had wanted to learn to meditate from the time that she was a little girl, but she was always steered away from it. She was prevented from it, including by her husband, good man that he was. It just wasn't what women did. That's the state of that culture at that time. So she didn't learn to meditate, but here she was at the literally dying, and she's desperate. And so she goes to the meditation center. And apparently, she literally crawled up the steps of that, whether it was a monastery, I don't remember the details, but she couldn't walk anymore, and she threw herself into practice. Now listen, she was 53 years old, and within 6 days, she had attained the first level of enlightenment. In 6 days. It's just unbelievable. And in the Theravada tradition, there are four levels of enlightenment, and she attained the subsequent three within an absolutely astonishingly short time. So she was an extraordinary, very rare kind of practitioner. She was a householder. She was not a monastic. She was well over halfway through her life. It's just such an inspiring story. Also, she was, she lived in a little two-room house, and people began to flock to her because they were so transformed by being in her presence. So the fact that she was a woman was also utterly astonishing because all the teachers at that time were men. And here was this extraordinary woman. So let me give you, I want to sort of, what should I say? It's just that I want to pull the cream off the top and give you some of the things that she taught, like kind of the essence of her teachings, so that you get, these are things that just so inspired me. I thought, well, I just have to share them with you. So first of all, she believed that enlightenment was possible in any environment. You didn't have to go to a monastery. You could, and she was a living example of it, become enlightened in the midst of householding life. That's such an inspiration. So she was, and she also guided, taught, inspired many other householders to attain wisdom, really, in the midst of their lives. And so she was eventually dubbed the patron saint of householders. I love that, the patron saint of householders, because there's no question but that she was a saint. So here are a few highlights. She said, "The whole path of mindfulness is this. Whatever you are doing, be aware of it." Simple, but not easy. But that's an essence practice. When she was asked about the difference between formal meditation practice and daily life, she adamantly insisted, "You cannot separate meditation from life. You cannot separate meditation from life. Life becomes meditation." She dwelled in such an enlightened state that her presence was a blessing. She blessed everybody, and she also blessed everything, including her car or, you know, inanimate objects. I have to say that when I lived in India on and off for a while at an ashram, and they blessed everything there. For example, they'd get a new tractor, and they'd make a garland of marigolds and put it around the front part of the tractor and do mantras to welcome the tractor into the community. I thought that was so beautiful, that if you see all objects as sacred, on some level they are, life becomes very different. It becomes very precious. And Ma would say, if you bless those around you, this will inspire you to be attentive in every moment, and it turns the ordinary into something special. And then you encounter grace wherever you go. So listen to what Joseph Goldstein had to say about her. "Ma's greatest gift was showing me what was possible and living it. She gave the sense that with courage of heart and right effort, anything is possible." And in one of her first teachings in America, she made the statement, "Meditation is love. Meditation is love." And true meditation is about how we care for ourselves and the world. And ultimately, meditation is the continual movement of love which encompasses everyone and everything. Isn't that beautiful? It's like that, as I share those words with you, I feel my own heart center, and that's what she's inviting us to live from this place, to live that love and bring that kind of meditative awareness into everything that we do in our lives. Because Jack Kornfield was one of my first teachers, let me tell you what he said. I love this story. He was in a group interview in her room where people were just jammed together because they wanted to be as close to her as they could. And he innocently asked her, it's something I've always wanted to ask people like the Dalai Lama. He asked her, "What is it like in your mind?" What is it like in your mind? And she smiled, and she closed her eyes, and she quietly answered, in my mind, there are three things: concentration, loving kindness, and peace. How beautiful is that? In my mind, there are three things: concentration, loving kindness, and peace. Well, apparently, Jack wasn't quite sure he'd heard right, so he said, is that all? And she said, yes, that is all. And Jack said very quietly, how wonderful. Isn't that wonderful? It gives me the shivers because, you know, I'll come back up, say a little something about the mind in a minute, but it's beautiful to have that question asked and hear that answer. You know, what is it like to have a mind that is liberated? I don't know about you, but I really want to know. Oh, I love it. Okay. So Deepa Ma was an extraordinary combination of pushing her students and bathing them in her love. And she would push students to their edge. You know, we all have an edge, and I know I need to be pushed toward it because it's sometimes easier not to be. So she pushed. She was could be a real taskmaster. She said, practice without regard for body or life. Oh. And with all the love in your heart. Practice without regard for body or life and with all the love in your heart. It's beautiful. So those are a few gems from Deepa Ma. This last statement that she made raises the question of effort and ease in our practice. And I'm sure some of you are familiar with the classic image that the Buddha used of tuning a lute, and that the string should not be either too tight or too loose. And you know, what does that mean for us? Sometimes I know I take these images and I don't really contemplate them fully, but it's a really interesting one to apply to how we're living. Are we striving too hard? Are we pushing? Are we over-efforting? Or when we're sitting, are we pushing ourselves too hard? Maybe sitting too rigidly, or trying to control our breath, or getting frustrated with our busy mind and striving. That's too tight. But on the other hand, we can be too loose. We can be lax. We can sort of say, oh, well, I'll meditate tomorrow or next week. Or in meditation, get sort of often a trance, taken over by those two wonderful words, sloth and torpor. I love those words. That's what the teachings say, you know, sloth or torpor, one of the obstacles, one of the hindrances. And I think probably most of us in the room kind of know what they are. Don't you? I do. Occasionally fall asleep in meditation. Anyways, so this whole issue of effort and ease, really, really interesting one. And it reminds me of a significant moment in my own journey. I want to just tell you a little story. I should preface the story by saying that I have a sort of lifelong pattern of doing exactly what I just talked about we shouldn't be doing, which is pushing myself a little bit too hard, making a to-do list, and then really wanting to get through it. I notice it how I shovel snow. Did you ever notice when you're doing some task and you can feel yourself, I just want to get through it, and you lose your mindfulness and you're pushing? It's, of course, the kind of time where we hurt ourselves. I just got a reminder in the last blizzard to slow down, not do it with so much force. So this is an issue in my life. Now, going back, I don't know how many years, into the early 70s, well, it must be almost 50 years ago, the very teacher, I forgot to mention to you who Deepa Ma's teacher was. It was Manindra. And Manindraji was a teacher to a lot of our teachers. And he came to Cambridge. He came to the West. He was at Insight Meditation Society in Barry a number of times. And when he came here to Cambridge, CIMC didn't exist. And I don't remember where his talk was. It was a long time ago. I certainly don't remember what he said. But after the talk, a small group of us went back to Mirabai Bush's apartment. Some of you may know Mirabai, with Manindraji for tea. So I was sitting there at the kitchen table, and he was sort of right here, and the conversation was sort of going here and there. And all of a sudden, he turns around, and out of the blue, he looks at me very directly, deeply, and he just says, "Always do everything with softness and ease." Oh boy. Did he have my number? Well, first of all, this was a very highly attained teacher. I think he could see my tendency was probably how I picked up my cup. I don't know. It was just like I felt he'd seen right into a pattern and given me this teaching. This was inspiring. And I never forgot it. And I've remembered it so many hundreds of times. Softness and ease. Softness and ease. And living here in Cambridge, a high pressure cooker kind of existence, I think. Do you know what I mean? With all the pressures of media and all the pressures in our lives, it's really easy to lose that. So I share that story with you. I put it in this book I just wrote, called it One of My Wisdom Treasures, because I got this teaching. And as I said earlier, sometimes these teachings come to us in very small packages. There were only two words, but I never forgot. So, where am I going to go from here? I want to tell you a thought-provoking story on this same topic from the Tibetan tradition. It's about Milarepa. Some of you may have heard of him. He was a outstanding yogi and poet, a towering figure in the Kagyu lineage of the Tibetan tradition. And before he got to where he got, he went to see Marpa, who became his teacher, another great yogi in that tradition. And he went to get instructions for doing a long retreat. And then he went into a cave. This was part of that tradition. I have to add that this story means a lot to me because after my husband died, I went on a pilgrimage to Tibet. And one of the places that we went in southern Tibet was to Milarepa's cave. And going into this place and knowing that this adept had sat there for years and some of the stories about him was really a very deeply moving experience. So as the story goes, he went to this cave at the southern cliffs near Marpa's residence. And after a couple of months, Marpa came to see him, came to visit his student, and said to him, "You are practicing very diligently, but why do you not take a break?" And Milarepa answered, "I do not need to take a break. Practice itself is taking a break." Very thought-provoking. So he had such intense enthusiasm for this intense practice that he didn't make a distinction between practice and non-practice. I mean, everything became practice. And so I think that's an inspiring kind of an example for us that practice, too, wants to have a kind of ease about it, wants to be that as we meditate, we're in a state of physical relaxation and so on. It's a very effortless, that balance between effort and effortlessness, very, very profound edge that we explore in our practice. So what about us? I mean, we hear these stories about Milarepa, about Dipa Ma, and where does it leave us? Well, once we have a meditation practice, obviously one of the most central, what should I say, focuses of our practice is inquiring into the nature of the mind. And I have to say that I'm not a compulsive reader, but I love to read. And I can't get enough of reading inspiring Dharma books. I mean, they say that's not where the answer is to be found, I know, but still. So often I'll read for maybe 10 minutes before I meditate in the morning. And so I just want to share with you maybe three topics that I've sort of been thinking about as I've been doing this contemplative reading, because that's really what it is. So first of all, I think that you can relate to this. We're not always aware of how captivated we are by our own stories, by our own personal narrative. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but what tends to happen is that the sense of self gets very linked into our stories. You know, the teachings remind us, of course, that this I is just a concept. Where is that I? Can you find it? There are absolutely wonderful exercises that help us to get to this place of realizing that the I can't be found, it's impermanent, it's non-existent in the way we other things are existent. It's always changing. There's nothing that you can point to that says, this is me, this is I. What is it? Very thought-provoking. It's a whole meditation in and of itself. It reminds me of one of the first great teachers that I found inspiration from was Ramana Maharshi, a great Hindu saint. And his primary practice was holding the question, what am I? What am I? Not who am I, but what am I? That was a whole practice because, of course, the question is unanswerable. Isn't that amazing? We're so attached to this I. So I come back to it over and over again. And of course, the heart of our practice is about transforming self-cherishing into concern and compassion for others. That's really, if you want to summarize what practice is about, what the transformation is that we are undertaking, it's that, from self-cherishing to compassion for others. There's a famous saying from Shantideva, who was an 8th century Indian adept, philosopher, great famous being. And he wrote a book, which I've read a number of times, called The Bodhisattva's Way of Life. It's a wonderful book. Doesn't matter what tradition you come from, it's full of inspiration. And one of the famous sayings from that book is this: all happiness there is in the world comes from thinking about others, and all suffering comes from preoccupation with yourself. Yeah. You can hear it over and over again. All the happiness there is in this world comes from thinking about others, and all the suffering comes from preoccupation with yourself. Yeah, you can really ponder that one. Yeah, and just watch the play of I in your conversation or whatever, where you notice it becomes solid. That's the tricky place, because it comes solid around our clashes, around our obstacles, around when we're feeling strong feelings like fear, anger, hatred, jealousy. There, the I becomes very solidified. And those are times to really look at this. This is a chance to sort of soften around that I and let it become more permeable. And how is that spectrum of feelings that you're experiencing affecting both you and the other person, if it involves another person? It's a whole practice. Okay, so here's a second, I think, wise perspective at looking at the mind. I just happened upon this recently, so I just wanted to share it with you because I went, oh, that's an interesting way of looking at it. This particular writer was saying the mind has three states. It has a lot more, but anyway, the way he was looking at it was the mind is either moving, which it is most of the time, or it's still, or there's the awareness that observes both. Those are the three things. So listen to this. I was reading a book by, I can't remember his name, but it was the Dalai Lama's tutor. And I just love to hear what he said about the mind and thinking. Listen to what he had to say. In the context of meditation, thoughts are completely useless. They serve no function. They are no good whatsoever. They are a complete waste of time. And they impede the progress of Dharma. And if you don't like all these useless thoughts, then you simply won't let them take over. He makes it sound so easy. I don't know. He was talking to very advanced students. But I thought, well, it's all true, isn't it, what he's saying? And do you know that back in the days when I was teaching at the Mind-Body Clinic, we used to tell our patients that, because we were teaching them meditation, that apparently 95% of the thoughts that we have been thinking today, we were thinking yesterday. That's kind of alarming. You know, it's like the mind is amazing. It's like a recycling machine, isn't it? You know, it's like these, I mean, you know your patterns, or at least I certainly know my patterns, but that doesn't mean they do tend to go away in a long retreat or get much softer. But noticing what your patterns are. Are you worrying? Are you rehearsing? Are you replaying previous conversations? Are you planning? Are you judging? Oh, there's a big one. Judging. Oh, that's a big one. And so on and on and on. And we need to bring so much compassion to the machinations of our own minds, because they are endlessly producing thought. So I just loved somehow that description. And of course, that's why we have an array of specific practices to give the mind a focus, you know, like the breath, like metta practices, like body-oriented practices. All of that, that's what we have to hew to get to remain steady. So perhaps the most precious source of inspiration lies in the very heart of our practice. And what is it? It's this awareness, that third state that those three states that I was referring to refers to. Awareness, pure awareness. It's our ultimate refuge. It's so subtle. The problem is you can't describe it, really. We know it. All of us know it. It's the space between thoughts. How is it described? It's described as spaciousness and openness, as emptiness, as shunyata, emptiness. And yet, it's utterly full, total capacity is, all capacities are there. It's such a paradox. In that emptiness is completeness, total completeness, infinitude. Everything is there. So, and finally, most important perhaps, by nature it is compassionate, and it's unconditionally loving. Like at our heart, in the very center of our being, we are compassionate self. We are unconditional love. And I think of it sometimes as light, the light of consciousness within the heart, within the core of our being, that is truly who we are, that timeless, ageless being that we are. And that's what draws us back over and over again to the cushion or to the chair, to meditate, to touch in on this ultimate refuge of pure awareness. Pure awareness, it's such an incredible gift. So the last one I want to mention, I've been reading, as I know a few of you in this room have been reading, Rodney Smith's book. Some of you know Rodney because he comes and gives talks here and occasionally a retreat, and is a very beloved friend for many years. And so I lap up every book he reads. This most recent one is called Touching the Infinite, I think a new perspective on the Buddha's four foundations of mindfulness. And you know, you can see the tremendous fruit of Rodney's practice in this book. So the practice that caught my attention, he calls here or nowhere. Here or nowhere. He says, notice, of course, how often the mind drifts away, how we disconnect from the moment, we drift into the past or the future, how often we're living in our head, not in our body, not fully embodied. And we need to explore the causes of our distraction. Everything somehow in today's world is encouraging us to be distracted. So, he says, listen to what he says. I love these words. He says, let us kneel and pay homage to the only place we could ever be, here and now. The only place we could ever be, here and now. This is where it all happens, day in and day out. This is where we wake up. This is where we awaken. This is where we will get enlightened. Oh, I have to tell you one more story. From Deepa Ma. I'm going to interrupt Rodney's. I just have to tell you this story. It's so great. So again, let yourself be back in her room where she's sitting on sort of a raised bed kind of with people all around her. But she's not feeling very well. And her eyes are closed. And Munindra is in another corner of the room and he's talking. And he's telling these people that, of course, only men can become Buddhas. And her eyes fly open, and she says, that's not true. I can do anything a man can do. I love that story, because she's not the only one, but there was this, assumption in the tradition that women couldn't get enlightened. It's absolutely untrue. And of course, it's shown by all these extraordinary women who've become enlightened, of whom she's one. And I happen to know a number of others. In any case, and we don't always know who's enlightened anyway, but I just want to say, I had to tell you that story because I loved it. I loved that she wouldn't let, he was her teacher, but boy, she surpassed him. I think by that time. Anyways, it's a great story. Let me get back to Rodney here. So, let us kneel and pay homage to the only place we could ever be, here and now. Here is as near to the sacred as we will ever find. It is the sacred. This place that cradles us, where we are fully embraced by the earth, held by the stars, and aligned with the universe. The laws of the universe run through this very body at this very moment. The body's composition is literally the stuff of stars born from exploding supernovas. Everything begins from the body's present location. That's his here and now practice. Here or nowhere. Because if you're not here, you're nowhere. And I just found this deeply arresting. It's to be reminded that it's all happening in this moment, right now, right here. And of course, we forget. You know, we forget the miracle that the human body is. We forget how precious this human life is. We forget how wondrous the mind is. And yet through our awareness practice, both in meditation and throughout the day, we have moments of remembering, of waking up, of awakening. It can happen anytime, anywhere. It's always possible. That's the inspiration. And so we can dedicate ourselves to this process of awakening, not just for ourselves, but for the lives that our lives touch, and really for the world.